We don't have a quorum yet, but I'd like to get going. We have a lot of bills to get through. Representative Hosh, are you ready? So we'll move the bill when we get a bring the meeting to order. Welcome to the committee.
Pardon, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to present House File 580, which deals with some input provisions in the family stabilization program. Before going into the details and the separate sections within the bill, I would just like to give an overview of exactly what the family stabilization program is and to make sure that the committee is aware of its goals. But in our statute, actually in 256J.575, it specifically states that the goal of the services, of family stabilization services, is to stabilize and improve the lives of families at risk of long-term welfare dependency or family infidelity due to employment barriers such as physical disability, mental disability, age, or providing care for a disabled household member. These services promote and support families to achieve the greatest possible degree of self-sufficiency. And I think that's important to keep in mind when we move forward and discuss this bill and other bills into the future. House File 580, Section 1 essentially expands the hardship exemption. Right now we have the current 60-month time limit for MFIP benefits. You can get a hardship extension if the individual is participating in unpaid work and job search activities for 12 months. So if somebody is still working and searching for a job but hasn't been successful, that there can be an extension as long as those efforts are being made.
And Representative Hosh, the hardship extension exists in state law. This is just adding a category.
This is adding a category, an eighth category, Mr. Chairman. Section 2 of the bill, that if information is available that eligibility is likely for the individual, that the county can then enroll the person into family stabilization services to move forward and get that individual the most appropriate services. Section 3, in all honesty, Mr. Chair, this is my favorite part of the bill, is it allows for a baccalaureate or an associate degree program to be eligible for a work activity. Study after study shows that education results in reduced recidivism and increased earnings for the individual. Section 4 of the bill says that if documentation isn't available for eligibility, but the individual is cooperating with the county and trying to pursue the needed documentation, that is good cause to not have a sanction placed on the individual. Essentially, what this bill does is try to reduce red tape for individuals to make sure that those that have illnesses and disabilities aren't sanctioned for inappropriate reasons and aren't negatively impacted. The educational component is also extremely important, but you know, the family stabilization program is one that ultimately can save the state of Minnesota by having a reduction in federal penalties if we don't meet the work participation guidelines. So I appreciate the committee's attention, and I will allow the testifiers who are much more knowledgeable and on this issue to be able to address the committee.
Okay, I'm going to bring the committee to order, first of all, and then Representative Hosh will move that House File 580 be recommended to pass and re-referred to Finance. And we're going to try to do, if we could do this like 5 minutes, would be great. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Actually, I'll only be a minute on this testimony. My name is Jessica Webster.
I actually moved that bill, not Representative Hosh.
Okay. I'm with the Legal Services Advocacy Project. This is a division of legal aid, and we represent thousands of low-income people across the state with free legal services. Now, the only piece of this bill that I really wanted to testify to pertains to the Family Stabilization Services Program, and I just wanted to tell you what prompted these changes. Legal aid has seen some clients come to our offices who may be eligible or are eligible for family stabilization services, but they're finding some delays, some administrative delays and administrative barriers to getting enrolled in the program. And these folks have serious disabilities or serious illnesses. Some of them have illnesses that are not going away, such as MS or something that may be recurring even though there are periods where they are their health is improving. So what we wanted to say is if a county worker knows that a person has an illness or has had an illness or a disability, and that might be the reason that they're having a hard time in the regular MSIF employment program, and they look eligible for family stabilization services, we want to untie the county worker's hands. And so if you have information that person should be in the program, you can put that person in the program, help them get the documentation, and it would flow that way. So there shouldn't be a cost to this that I know of. It's more of an administrative change and just makes the program work a little bit easier for the county worker and for the client.
Thank you. Any questions to the bill? We do have an amendment. Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question to that point, and this is my trying to make sense of many different budget categories this year and how they're handled. The example you gave of someone with MS, why is it that if it's a situation where it's a long-term chronic situation that might make it difficult for them to be employed in a normal situation, why is it they are not in the process of qualifying for SSI for a longer-term disability situation as opposed to an MDIP situation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, that's a good question, and they very well may be waiting for an SSI determination while they're in family stabilization services.
Representative Bunn?
Well, given that we're talking about a 60-month lifetime thing and then family stabilization making some exceptions to kind of go extend that horizon a bit for special circumstances, at least that's my understanding, that would appear to, under the current system, already give you many, many years possibly to have discovered a more permanent disability situation, and they could have pursued that within the 60-month time frame. So I'm just asking for clarification.
Ms. Webster or Ms. Flick?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, I'm not sure what you're asking in terms of the 60 months.
I think the question is 60 months seems a long enough time to get an SSI determination. That's the question. Is it enough time? And so why do, if someone has that type of disability, if they would have gotten on the ball right away, once they be qualified before 60 months runs out? I think, is that fair? Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, I think that question is a little bit beyond my expertise, and I would defer maybe to the Department of Human Services or another advocate.
Okay. Representative Thiessen and Representative Bunn and committee members, I'm Deborah Schlick. I'm with the Affirmative Options Coalition. So before I offer my testimony, I'd like to answer your question. I used to work at Ramsey County Human Services, and we worked with these families. The situations we find is that until the participants had someone who helped them navigate both the medical system and the disability system, what they would come to the doctor with would be dismissed as backache. That was particularly true of a client who had multiple sclerosis. So it takes some advocacy to get both the appropriate diagnosis, and then advocacy to get through what is often up to a 2-year disability process. The other thing that's important to understand about the families who qualify for family stabilization services, both in Minnesota and in research shows in most states in the country, is they're likely to have multiple functioning impairments. So the MS may be the one that sort of made it on top of the list. It's quite likely there's a mental illness there or a cognitive disability as well, and it's that combination of multiple diagnoses that put these families at such risk.
First member.
It's probably better, Mr. Chair. My question is that once you do the amendment, if the amendment's going to be done?
Sure, yeah, it is.
All right,
any other questions on the text? Oh, is now where's Representative? Oh, there he is. Representative Abler is going to move the AA1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's on a semi-related matter. This has to do with asset limitations, and I don't know if you want any testimony on this, but this comes from my county. And they discovered that some of the items of people's business income that they use in their household incomes weren't included in the computations, and it simply includes those. So.
And, yes. And I think it's legislation that we've dropped in, you and I. Is that right? Or
yeah. 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 This is a bill in.
Any discussion on the amendment? All right. Oh, you do want to respond, Representative Hosh? I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd just like to say that I would support this, that the intention of these programs are to make sure it's to those who are most in need, and this is an amendment that I look forward to a further discussion on.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of the A1 amendment. Oh, Resident Hayden, did you want to? Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this the appropriate time to are we going to be able to discuss the amendment, or just?
We can do it now.
Okay, so I just would like to understand that a tad bit better, Representative Abler, in terms of how that process worked and how there was a loophole. I guess I don't quite know if a person owned their own business, how when they fill out the CAF and all the forms that they have to, that the county missed it, or somehow they wouldn't be able to talk about that income.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden does know I'm actually a ventriloquist. If Ms. Bellis could come down, I will actually, she'll be moving her mouth and I'll be talking when she answers that question.
Yeah, fair enough. Welcome to the committee. So what does that make you? Sorry. My day. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Maureen Bellis, and I am a social services lobbyist for Anoka County. And the genesis for this particular amendment came from a situation which, in fact, you may have read about in the newspapers, because it did indeed make some of the newspapers, in which an individual who was basically operating a business out of his home was able to qualify for medical assistance by essentially reducing income by folding all of his personal expenses and calling them business expenses. So, in other words, the money that was owed by the family for groceries and rent and other medical care essentially was all deducted, so that the family, though they were doing quite well, ended up being medical assistance eligible on the income side, because they had been basically able to take all of their expenses out.
Representative Hayden.
So I'm scrambling to find the amendment. I thought that Representative Abler's amendment was an asset check. I'm sorry, I didn't know.
It, yeah. President Leland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I actually, certainly we don't want people to be doing this. I mean, I think we all agree on that. I think, though, there's a little bit of an issue about whether we need to do this amendment to accomplish this. As I'm sitting here reading it, it says that you're excluding capital and operating assets that the local agency determines are necessary to the person's ability to earn an income. And it seems to me that the things we're talking about here, things used for personal expenses, etc., are not necessary to the person's ability to earn an income and should have been excluded anyway. So I'm wondering if this isn't more, Representative Abler, this is your amendment. Maybe this, isn't this really an enforcement issue and not one of needing to actually change the law?
There is testimony in Anoka County that Anoka County actually is enforcing the law with this language, but there's other counties that feel like they can't, that the language is not clear enough. I think that's correct, right, Representative Abler?
I believe so, yeah. And the witness could clarify, but that's the intent, is to make it clear that these programs are for the needy, not for the not needy.
So, Mr. Chair, so we're not really changing the law at all. We're just clarifying what should be the practice right now.
Exactly.
So, Mr. Chair, we're just reiterating what we already know. I'm just getting used to how things work. So
I think
it just sounds like we're reiterating what we already know, and thus, because I guess my concern, and I should just say this off the top, is that we're taking maybe small isolated issues or incidents that happen and then making them into really broad-based law. And I'm just concerned that if this is already happening and it's an enforcement issue and we want to say, really, we want you to do it, I'm comfortable with that. But if this is a small isolated incident and that ultimately people who start their own business are now going to be precluded from getting help if they need it, a small business that a person may need it because they may not make enough income, that now we are putting in statute something that prevents them from getting the help that they need.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to restate that. I don't have time to spend this, but it deserves all the discussion it needs. But what the situation is, if you have a business income and you pay your more, if you reduce your income on the Schedule C business side of it by calling everything a business expense, you have almost no income left.
Mm-hmm.
And people's income goes toward buying groceries and toward paying a mortgage. Those are all income that you think people would account in determining their eligibility for MA or anything else. And so this just restates that these services are for people who need them, not who are clever and who are able to be. These would be denied on an audit of the IRS, but they didn't get audited to find that out. That's the kind of things these are. They're wrong Schedule C deductions that lower their income. Does that help?
It does. Mr. Chair, have we figured out what the impact would be to the counties to provide this to, if they're not already enforcing this, what additional cost there would be?
To the witness.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm not certain about additional cost, but I do know that what the language does, it puts additional tools in the hand of the frontline workers, basically kind of guiding them along the path of the questions to ask. So hopefully in the end, it would save money for the county.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a question either to Representative Abel or maybe to Ms. Bellis. I'm wondering if this amendment is adopted and goes forward, if the counties would be able to come back to us and let us know if the language that we've put in place to, you know, block what we don't want to happen is catching people that we don't intend it to catch. I just think it would be good that if we run into a problem that we don't intend to, if there'd be a way to get that kind of information back, even anecdotally.
Ms. Caldwell is going to just come down and tell us. I think that they will work with us on that, but here she comes.
Mr. Chair, members, I think Representative Murphy, that we could certainly do kind of a straw poll or ask people to keep their eyes open for this. You know, if it's not a real survey report kind of a thing, I think that we could certainly do that. You know, since it came up at the request of Anoka County, I haven't heard about this particular situation from any other counties, but I guess we have to now, so I think that we're glad to do that too. And I don't think, in response to an earlier question, Representative Hayden, I don't think it would propose additional cost to counties. We're pretty hypersensitive to that right now, as you probably have gathered. But it seems to me that it would just give counties a little more authority to enforce it.
Thank you. Any further discussion on the amendment? Okay, seeing none. All in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. To the bill. Further discussion on the House File 580. Representative Memmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hosh, in Section 3 of the bill, you referenced new language, which isn't really new language. I don't understand why we're changing it. What's the difference between an associate program and a baccalaureate program versus a post-secondary program that must last 24 months?
Representative Hodge.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, currently a baccalaureate program could exceed the 24-month threshold, and I think one of the goals is to ensure that somebody can improve their earning potential and reduce recidivism, and that is one of the goals of this. Currently, that 24 months is the limit, and I think that study after study shows that that is, in all honesty, poor policy.
Mr. Representative Chair, so Representative Hosh, I'm not familiar with study after study, but so somebody could be enrolled in a four-year institution or perhaps even in a graduate program, and they could theoretically qualify?
Representative Hosh.
I'm sorry.
They could be in a graduate program or a four-year baccalaureate program, and they would qualify, or you can distinguish among those if you want.
Mr. Chair, I believe a graduate program would not be considered eligible.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, this does not change the fact that you can only be in a program for 24 months. What it does say is that you can be in a baccalaureate program, so a four-year program, that
for 24 months rather than just maybe an associate's program.
Mr. Chair, so what you're saying is you can be in a 24-month program and that you complete over a four-year period?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, no, I'm saying that, for instance, if I am a person who has 2 years in a baccalaureate program and I have a crisis and I also have children, that I wouldn't be prohibited from finishing my degree in that four-year program. I would be able to take 24, I mean, if I needed MFIT for 24 months, which I may not, but I would be able to continue in my four-year program. I wouldn't be prohibited from participating in that when I'm an MFIT participant.
All right. Mr. Chair, there is an area that, if you go, Representative Hosh, to page 7, and I think it's section 5, the language that you've added with subpart D, 3D, how much is that going to cost?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, well, due to the policies that we're doing this year, especially with fiscal notes, having to go to a finance committee before a fiscal note is given by the department, I don't have a definitive answer for that. But if we move this forward into the finance committee, you'll be the first one I'll inform on what the cost would be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I want to seek further clarification on Representative Mayor's first question. Given that the language 24 months is crossed out entirely, I was a little unclear about the testifier's response in terms of saying it would only be allowed up for 24 months still, that that would still be intact, but it could be a baccalaureate and not just a two-year program. So what is constraining it to 24 months overall of educational if this language is gone?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, I can be corrected if I'm wrong, but that is on the federal guidelines that restrict it to 24 months.
Okay. Okay.
Representative Emmer, one.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I want to follow up on that. The policy part of that section 3D and section 5 or subpart 3D, you put language in here that says that the county agency or employment service must assist the participant. What do you mean? I mean, are they going to go out and when you say must assist, are we going to say that they have to go and search out documents? Because this is a fundamental change. You're saying that instead of having the applicant present the requisite documentation to qualify, you're now putting the burden on the county agency or employment service to go out and find that. What exactly do you intend by that language?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, it's actually not a fundamental change. Many, many counties are actually doing this already. They help participants to get documentation. It might be as simple as letting the participants have a fax sent to the county office. It might be a county worker helping you think about the documentation you need or follow up or help make a phone call to get current documentation. And we have met with the counties on this. This is not a provision that the counties said they were concerned about. This is something that Family Stabilization Services providers are already doing with participants.
I appreciate that. I am concerned about it. Sorry, but when you put in law must assist, it's one thing right now if they have the discretion to make that decision, but when you start to legislate that they must do it, and then if you turn the page, you basically have the same burden that you're now putting on the county agency or employment services with respect to notifying an applicant of the right to bring an advocate. In the past, it was that the participants may, if they so choose, but now you're legislating an additional requirement or burden on the agency that they have to advise them of that. So I think it is a fundamental change, regardless of whether they're doing it or not, and that causes me some concern, and I'll just leave it there.
Any further discussion on the bill?
Just a quick question. On that section 3 again about the change into the baccalaureate, do you expect this portion of it to have any fiscal note or would this portion be neutral?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, I do not think it would have a fiscal impact. It just allows greater flexibility to have a four-year program apply as a work activity.
Okay.
Seeing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 5A to be recommended pass and referred to finance as amended. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Szymanski, House File 272.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the bill for my colleague.
Representative Abler moves that House File 272 be recommended to pass and referred to finance. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The bill before you is dealing with the process of finger imaging for the purposes of public assistance. And excuse me if I'm a little bit nervous today. I didn't realize till earlier today that I would be on the docket for your committee. But the bill simply asked the Commissioner of Human Services to establish and implement a finger imaging system such that the recipients of public assistance would be providing details, basically biometric specimen for receiving benefits. I simply wanted to bring this bill before the committee today in an effort to, in the difficult times of balancing budgets, to try and preserve as much of the benefits for the needy recipients that we can. We want to also preserve the integrity of the human services benefit systems and prevent abuse at the most economical point, and that would be at the point of the transaction. We would also like to assure taxpayers that the funds that are delivered are going to the appropriate recipients, and we would, in adopting this system, employ 21st century technology to expedite with up-to-date data for access to the providers. We'd also be working to reduce or prevent an incentive for identity theft for fraudulent use of social services. At this point, I would stand for any questions.
Mr. Weber?
Well, I was just talking with Mr. Szymanski before. The committee can do as it wished, but he read about this idea, and it's used in a few states, and he wanted to bring the idea to us. He personally isn't interested if we vote on it or not. He just wanted to bring this idea into the mix of ideas. So that's just a pleasure of the chair.
Is there anybody in the audience? Representative Liebling.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Szymanski. I'm just wondering what problem you're trying to solve here. I mean, do you have evidence that there's fraud that would be resolved with this kind of an approach? Or, you know, could you go into that a little bit for us, please?
Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Liebling. The evidence would be presented. I don't have any examples with me today. Again, I said because of my short preparation time on this, I do apologize for not bringing full data with me today. But this would refer to prosecutions at the county level for wrongfully obtaining public assistance and so forth. And we see in our newspapers on a weekly basis, the court systems are prosecuting those cases routinely.
We have a couple of testifiers that maybe can shed more light on it, and then we'll go to questions if that's okay. The people have signed up to testify. Mr. Roberts, welcome. And if Ms. Moriarty wants to also come to the table, that's great. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much, Chairman Keeson. My name is Ethan Roberts, and I have copies of the testimony which I'm about to give to you today. I am the director of the, thank you so much, of the Twin Cities Jewish Community Government Affairs Program, and I come here today on behalf of the JCRC, Jewish Community Relations Council, as well as the half dozen Jewish social service agencies that I represent in Minnesota, and the several thousand low-income Jewish and non-Jewish children, families, and senior citizens that we serve who are in public assistance. And I come here today to strongly urge this committee to stand in opposition to this bill on both practical and moral grounds. As a practical matter, we are gravely concerned that we're requiring all Minnesotans including children, to be fingerprinted as a condition of eligibility for public assistance, that this bill will create an undue hardship for our most vulnerable clients and will cause many to forego the public assistance-funded services they so desperately need. Let me just give you one example. Considering the over 1,000-plus Jewish and non-Jewish medical assistance-eligible Minnesotans that we serve every year who are seniors, we are confident that many of them, including those who are frail, afflicted by memory loss and dementia, lack transportation, and suffer from depression, will recoil in fear and confusion by this law and find compliance to be very difficult. We are also certain that many of our seniors, rather than submitting to what they will perceive as being treated like common criminals, will make the terrible decision to forsake the hot meal, the bus ride, or home visit from a nurse or case manager that they now receive through the nonprofit agencies I represent, but is made possible in part through the public assistance dollars they receive. In particular, I am extremely concerned about our elderly immigrants from the former Soviet Union and our dwindling number of Holocaust survivors whose terrible experiences of communism and fascism make them acutely apprehensive about the government and especially likely to be either traumatized or paralyzed by this law. And just to underscore this point, not in the testimony, I was speaking today with someone who runs the senior program at the JCC, the Jewish Community Center in St. Paul, and she said that some of the Russian clients, they're reluctant to even use the ID cards that we give them because of their experiences. That we gave them. We resettled these people. They trust us. The prospect, honestly, of these people going to the government is quite different than it is for you or I. Additionally, we are very uneasy about our ability to provide our services in these difficult economic times without the public assistance dollars our clients are eligible for and with just our diminishing private resources. Finally, we know that our concerns are not idiosyncratic to our Jewish community and the Jewish and non-Jewish people that we serve, and that these fears, which I have just articulated, are shared by so many, including, and this is interesting, if you look in the DHS website, you understand or realize that nearly 10% of Minnesotans, over 500,000, are now eligible for medical assistance, and the thousands more people who are eligible for other forms of public assistance. Finally, with respect to the moral point, I agree with Rabbi Marcia Zimmerman from Temple Israel in Minneapolis, who recently urged us to resist efforts such as this bill, as well as its sister bills, House Files 646 and 1036, that would build unsustainable walls, divisions, between those who are in need right now for public assistance and the rest of us. In her Tuesday address at the Capitol Rotunda to the throng of clergy that had gathered in solidarity with the most vulnerable among us, Rabbi Zimmerman observed, in these times of great economic distress, the they and the we have lately become greatly confused. Recalling a congregant that recently sold her dining room table just to pay for antidepressants, sorry if that's not depressing enough, Rabbi Zimmerman could just as easily have been speaking of our neighbors recently laid off at Circuit City or Hutchinson Tech, our mother-in-law who just moved into a nursing home, or our son's classmates who would go hungry, but for the food and cash assistance their families received from the state. Furthermore, at a time when the day could so suddenly become us, the golden rule taught by the ancient Rabbi Hillel that what is hateful to you, do not do to your fellow, has particular resonance and makes us wonder who here in this committee or in this room would want to be fingerprinted, or worse, who here would want their child to be fingerprinted as a condition for receiving basic needs such as food, clothing, shelter, and yes, medical care. And considering the merits of this bill, we ask you to strongly consider the very real concrete damage it will do to vulnerable people, as well as the divisive message it sends to the community. Thank you very much for your time and the great honor of being provided the opportunity to address this committee.
Thank you, Representative Scott Walsh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Roberts, with all due respect, I have questions too about the practicality of this yet and the technology. There seems to be a lot of effort moving in this direction for positive identification of many people. Technology is moving in this direction. I don't think it's meant to be the kind of Machiavellian thing that you're describing, but I have the same concerns. So let's understand that. But my question to you is this. I think what the idea of being brought forward here in the bill is a way of being more sure about who is receiving benefits, that the person who's actually supposed to be receiving the benefits, which in my mind from a social justice perspective is a person who is eligible, a person who is actually in need should be the one receiving the help. And we do actually have evidence. I've heard testimony. We've actually, I was at a presentation by three investigators, welfare fraud, who've indicated there's a black market for EBT cards. There is a great deal of fraud, some estimate as much as 15% of this money being spent and sent off to people who don't qualify for it. So this is a dispersion of funds that are meant to help people in need that are going elsewhere. And I think the goal of this sort of legislation is to try to get that positive identification going. Now, I too have concerns about, you know, are you thumbprinting? I would think not children. I don't think young people are going to be using EBT cards. But my question of you is what is the concern about that philosophy that I think actually is trying to help people in need rather than hurt them somehow?
Mr. Roberts.
Well, in terms of the funding issue, I don't know if I understand the policy of this committee that there won't be a fiscal note until if it gets out of this committee and referred. But my sense is that this could be very expensive. And so that at the time of let's be honest, it's a $6.4 billion deficit. What you decide to do with the FMAP money is another story. That monies would be diverted from actually providing meals and rides and medical care and would be going into the system. And I also note that half the cost would be borne by the counties. In my experience talking to my executives, none are aware in their own experiences of any fraud. I don't believe that our nursing home patients, nursing home patients is one person per room. We're not double delivering meals. Now, I can't say that there's never been fraud, but it seems, in my previous life, I was an attorney, and it seems like it's normally you try when you're balancing, you know, how the intrusion, the difficulty was the benefit. I think that there could be a much less restrictive means. And finally, I really do, the second point beyond the practicality, I think it's really saying there's something, think about who gets fingerprinted. Criminals and, yes, people who are pursuing certain jobs. My wife is a teacher. She's been fingerprinted. Of course, she works with children. I understand that law enforcement officials. But I really think it says there's something wrong about you. And quite honestly, when I think about this economy, I picture myself, quite honestly, having to go down to Hennepin County and fingerprint myself. And finally, regarding children, I believe the bill, in fact, I know the bill specifically says, including minors.
I think we're going to just finish up the testimony here, and then we can get to questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Colleen Moriarty, and I'm the Executive Director of Hunger Solutions Minnesota. I'm here today to discuss how these bills would affect food support in the state of Minnesota. Food support has been recognized, along with unemployment benefits, as two of the most effective economic stimulus devices that are evidenced by their inclusion in the recent recovery package. In the case of food support, an additional $20 billion was allocated for this purpose. For every $5 of new food support benefits, $9.20 is generated into the local economy. The unprecedented economic downturn, food inflation, is putting a major strain on an already weak family budget. Food insecurity impacts 10% of Minnesota's population. Food shelves and other emergency food programs are under pressure to meet this unusual demand for food assistance from middle-class families suffering from underemployment, unemployment, home foreclosure, food cost inflation, and other financial strains. The system is simply not set up to meet this demand. Food support outreach to potentially eligible jobless and senior Minnesotans and the working poor is essential to alleviating hunger. Currently, Minnesota has only enrolled 69% or 308,000 of the eligible participants in the program. There was an almost 20,000 increase in individuals from December of 2007 to 2008. Besides the impact on health and nourishment of Minnesota families, full participation in this program would yield approximately $394 million in federal assistance to meet the immediate food needs in the state. By reaching the highest need communities, reducing participation barriers, implementing proven outreach strategies, and communicating the additional resources clients can access, headway can be made towards the goal of enrolling all Minnesotans in federally funded programs. The bills that are under consideration today are in direct conflict with our efforts to assure that seniors, as well as families and children in our state, are not choosing between heat or food, medicine or food, and shelter or food.
fingerprinting requiring of IDs are expensive technologies to enforce and to implement. They are unnecessary at a time when the federal government is providing more flexibility on how these programs should be administered by states. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Schlick?
Chairman Houston and committee members, I'm Deborah Schlick with the Affirmative Options Coalition. We're a coalition of nonprofits across the state of Minnesota, and we advocate for effective welfare to work and public assistance policies. I'd like to address some of the questions that have already come up from members. Because we care about effective public assistance policy, we did some research on the fingerprinting issue. And we share Representative Gottwald's concern. If fraud is allowed, people who need resources don't get those resources. But we are concerned with what we learned about fingerprinting. Fingerprinting became very popular among a set of states in the late 1990s. At one point, there were up to 11 states who were experimenting or actually using fingerprinting throughout their state system. As of right now, only 4 states appear to have stayed in the fingerprinting business: Texas, Arizona, New York, and California. The independent evaluations done of the states that have been using fingerprinting have found that there are extraordinarily small outcomes for a lot of money. So, for instance, in New York State, that state found that fewer than 1/3 of 1% of all applicants were actually trying to enroll in under duplicate names. And in fact, in 2004, because of that, the state of New York dropped its requirement that counties fingerprint public assistance recipients, quote, having determined that it offered little additional anti-fraud protection beyond the other screening that is done as part of the applicant review. Likewise, Texas. When Texas piloted its fingerprinting efforts, in that initial pilot, they fingerprinted more than 19,000 people. They found not one case that was fraudulent. And an independent review done by the University of Texas at the request of the state determined that the demonstration cost the state of Texas $1.7 million for the first 7 months of operation. It was very localized. It was not statewide and yielded no savings in benefit payments. In Illinois, almost 17,000 people were fingerprinted in that state's pilot effort. Only 34 cases were referred for investigation. Of the 34 cases, only one was an actual multiple enrollment, and the Illinois Department of Public Aid said in its report, our current system of matching should have identified this duplicate to casework staff without biometric information. California, more than 18,000 people were fingerprinted in a 2.5-year period at a demonstration site, only 45 cases of concern raised. The legislative auditor in California has noted that the state spends $11.4 million a year. They do not account for the county costs, so one sample county, Riverside, said they spend $1.4 million, and that there are no measurable results for those expenses. In fact, the only savings that have been documented were documented by a study commissioned by the United States Department of Agriculture in 2007 that found that fingerprinting applicants results in a 4.3% decline in the use of food stamps by eligible households. People who, as Mr. Roberts and Ms. Moriarty testified, are either confused, uncomfortable with the fingerprinting process, and so go without the benefits for which they're eligible. The USDA considered this a poor outcome, noting that the effectiveness of the food stamp program depends on the extent to which it reaches those who are actually entitled to benefits. But fingerprinting public assistance applicants is good for biometric businesses. All the states except Illinois have used one vendor to roll out their food stamp program. When you do the research, the enthusiasm you find for fingerprinting is in the industry publications. I quote one in a fact sheet we handed out.
And a lot of this information is in actually a handout in your pack.
That the use of fingerprinting in civil applications such as public benefits and national ID programs represents a growth area for the new technology.
The author goes on to point out the correction system is sort of saturated for the industry. This is where you can find customers. So we think it is expensive, we think it is humiliating, and we think it is ineffective. It meets none of our tests for wise use of resources during a time of significant budget problems.
Is the department here? Is Mr. Johnson here? I just, on the question of cost, do we know if there is...
Mr. Chair, Chuck Johnson, the Department of Human Services. The question is cost.
Yeah. Do we have any information on that?
We have not done
the benefit of it.
We have not done a formal fiscal note on this yet. We have looked at it in the past, and my memory is that there are costs, and that that we don't book any offset in savings that is greater than the cost of actually setting up the operation to begin with. But we would have to do a fiscal note on it to be sure.
Thank you, Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe you can rule on a germaneness issue, but I just had a question about that.
Yeah.
What's that?
I can't do that here.
Okay. Well, in 2005, when the legislature passed the conceal and carry legislation updates, one thing that the county sheriffs were expressly prohibited from doing was taking fingerprints of conceal and carry applicants, and since it's the health and Human Services Committee, I wonder if it would be germane to have an amendment to change that.
I don't know if it's germane, but I don't think we're going to go down that path today.
Mr. Chair, just out of respect for the author and the good dialogue we've had, I think it's good when people bring forward ideas that are as interesting and as controversial as this, and you might actually find some you like, but he met with me before the hearing, and he was glad to have a chance to present his idea. I think he's heard some interesting feedback, and if I could ask that it be laid over at this time, that would be very nice.
All right, that's not debatable. All in favor of laying over House File 272, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Manson. Representative Seifert. I'll move that House File 1036 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, House File 1036 is a pretty straightforward bill that was brought to me. It's been brought to me by constituents pretty much every year I've been in the legislature. It is a question I put on my legislative survey multiple times that has a 91% to 97% approval from the people that I represent when asked the question straight up. You have people moving from other states that have the benefits of the states they're coming from rather than the benefits of the state of Minnesota. Everyone around the table knows you probably can't get that many people to agree the sky is blue. I understand the questions and concerns people have had about the court ruling, whether this is a bill that meets constitutional muster, but as many members know, we try to do what we think is right in representing our constituents and know that the Supreme Court changes its mind on things on many different occasions, sometimes rightfully and sometimes not. But I would argue that in the case of the payments, people argue whether people come here or not for benefits. I don't even want to get into that argument. Human Services looked up some data for me in a one-year time snapshot. Had asked how many people from another state or country had applied for public assistance in one or more of our four largest programs. In 2007, it was over 13,000 people. And I don't think that's a small number, and that is just a one-year snapshot. So, Mr. Chair, I think it's a common sense bill. If there's a court challenge, we have a very able Attorney General, Ms. Swanson, who is sworn to uphold the laws of the legislature that we pass. I think it has broad support amongst the general public, and we'll stand for any questions. I don't want to take a lot of committee time up with the bill. I think you all understand what it's about.
Representative Member.
Mr. Chair, Representative Seifert, I think this has been raised in the past, and you talk about these court challenges. This you're not proposing that somebody moving to the state just would have no access to benefits. You're just trying to make sure that they are maintained at the level from the state that they come from for a period of time. Do I understand that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman. Representative Emmer, we are not proposing that people be cut off and build some type of wall at the border that people can't come in and access any benefits. What we are saying is that if you are reaching a time limit in another state or coming here for whatever reason, that you follow, that those benefits follow you along from wherever you're coming from. I do believe DHS has, there's somebody here who has that information somewhere on the, at least the neighboring states and what their benefit packages are. As someone who comes from western Minnesota, I can tell you, Mr. Chair, in the data that we had, there are some very acute spikes in first-time welfare applicants in Wilkin County. It is almost 50%. Those are first-time applicants, are people from other states. And I think in tough times, we in Minnesota ought to take care of those who are temporarily on tough times, regardless of what their circumstances are, a family conflict, unemployment, whatever. But for people coming from all over the place to come into Minnesota and take advantage of the state treasury and our goodwill, I think there are a lot of folks, at least in my district, who have said, you know what, we will prove that, whether it's a magnet or not, as Representative Emmer said, we're not saying we're going to go down to zero. We're just saying you're going to bring the benefits along then from wherever you came from.
Chair.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Representative Seifert. So if someone relocates to Minnesota, what's the period of time that they would ordinarily have to wait to qualify for benefits?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, it depends on which benefit you're talking about. If we are talking about MFIP payments, I believe there is it 60 or 90 days now that we have. Representative Huntley would know off the top of his head, I bet.
Somebody knows, Mr. Chair. I thought it was 30 or maybe even.
I know that there is some sort of a period.
30 days.
Maybe staff can tell us.
Is it 30 days, Mr. Chair? Someone's nodding 30 days. We had a floor amendement. I think that's what I'm
surprised. Why don't we just have her answer the question?
Mr. Chair, members, I believe it is in statute that the residency requirement is 30 days, but there are some exceptions for hardship.
Mr. Chair, and then along those lines, and I apologize, Representative Seifert, I guess we didn't realize it's even more generous than you thought, but in terms of residence, how does somebody become a Minnesota resident? Is it a certain period of time, or is it instantaneous once you relocate here and you declare that Minnesota is your state of residence? Do you become automatically a resident?
Representative Seifert.
I'll defer to staff on that, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and Representative Emmer, I think in statute, I don't know the exact wording, but I think you have to establish residency and intend to stay here as your permanent home.
Right. Mr. Chair, Ms. Lemire, is there a period of time, though, or is it just from the moment that you declare that this is your permanent residence and that you, is that all it takes?
Well, some of the programs, Mr. Chair and Representative Emmer, do have the 30-day requirement, but there are hardship exceptions, I think. So in the case of a hardship extension, I think it is just, you know, you move here and say that you intend to stay here as your home.
All right. Mr. Chair, Representative Seifert, so if that's the case, you're not picking and choosing who gets this. It would be based solely on maintaining the level of service, the level of help that you're receiving from wherever you're coming from, regardless of whether you have a special hardship or not. Is that correct?
That would be correct, Mr. Chair. Representative Emmer, if you read the language on here, it states simply that the amount is no greater than the amount equal to the lesser of the benefits actually received in the state of last residence. In situations like Wilkin County and Clay County, where we have some very high and acute levels that are very noticeable of folks coming from other places, living in Wolverton, Minnesota, versus living over in Hankinson, North Dakota, I would find it hard to believe that the cost of living would be that much different. But because of those high numbers, a lot of people feel there is an incentive to come to Minnesota for the benefits, and this would be to basically say we're going to try to protect the Minnesota taxpayers. This doesn't do anything for a Minnesotan who is temporarily on tough times, who may be from Minneapolis, Duluth, wherever. It doesn't affect their benefits one penny. If anything, it may save some money so we might be able to help people more.
Mr. Chair, I am done, but I think it's an excellent proposal for that last statement, and when we do vote, I would ask for a roll call.
Okay.
Thanks.
Mr. Holly.
Well, Mr. Chair, this quite clearly violates the Constitution, which guarantees the right of free travel between states. The Supreme Court has ruled on this in numerous states. It's clearly a waste of time. But not only that, Mr. Chair, it's also a waste of money. And the Attorney General does not do these cases for free. The Attorney General has to bill the Department of Human Services to defend this bill. And we have at least a $5 billion budget deficit right now. I don't know why we would pass a bill that would increase the deficit that we have, so I urge everybody to vote against it. And by the way, it needs to go to the Finance Committee.
It is going to the Finance Committee.
Sound excited to
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Seifert. You know, before we have a solution, it's usually best to identify that there's really a problem. And I hope we're going to hear from the department here, because when we talk to, I think, Mr. Johnson, you know, there's really, there's no clear evidence that there is that we're any welfare magnet here, if we ever were. But I just want to ask you a little bit about some of the numbers you gave us, and just kind of point out that the way this gets talked about is often very misleading. You made a statement that about 13,000 people on our programs are from another country. Another state or country. Well, my husband, who's been living in Minnesota since 1994, is from another state, you know. I mean, lots of us, if we raise our hands, a lot of people in this room might be from another state. And, you know, the real question, I think, is how many are applying for our programs, you know, how many who are applying soon after they get here. That's really the issue. Because I think the problem you're trying to solve here is that so-called welfare magnet problem. And frankly, I'm not convinced there is such a problem. And when you talk about how many people on our programs are from other places, I think that's a very misleading way to talk about it. I've noticed that often when I get the mail, you know, from certain sectors who are complaining about all the money, so-called, that we're spending on illegal immigrants, the data they send me to back that up is not about illegal immigrants at all. It talks about immigrants. Well, lots and lots of people in this country are immigrants, and lots of them are contributing citizens, and many of them have been here many, many years. And I think it's very unfair to talk about those two things together and mix them up the way often happens. And I think it really insults a lot of good, patriotic Americans who are just as valuable citizens as anybody else. And I'd really like to, you know, ask you, with the amount of influence that you have, to please be very careful and to ask people not to do that, because I think it serves us all very poorly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Levin, there's a point well taken, but the data I requested was within 1 year of application, were you from another state or country, and the Human Services Department gave me the data by county, and it was over in the calendar year or fiscal year of 07, in a one-year snapshot, it was 13,000 people came from another state or country to Minnesota and enrolled in one or more of our four largest programs. So it wasn't, have you ever lived in another state? It was, within the last year, have you come from another place other than Minnesota? In trying times, Mr. Chair, my job as a state representative, when I raise my hand and swear to the Constitution of the U.S. and the state of Minnesota, I try to take care of my Minnesotan constituents, who are very much wondering why it's their job to have folks coming from all over the place and enrolling in our welfare program. It's a fair question. There are very few people who want to raise it. It's a sticky question. It is emotional for some people. But I can tell you that if it comes to
having to say yes to the Minnesotans who are on hard times and telling folks coming from other places that you are going to have the benefit package of the state you're coming from. And the way I'm reading this, and I think the staff would confirm this, that, you know, if you're coming from another place as a refugee, that's a whole different set of deal. That's a whole different issue. What we're talking about here is coming from another state in the United States. And I think that it makes common sense to the average person. It may not to the people around the table, but the average person, if you go out and ask them, do you think it makes sense that you carry the package with you in the state you're coming from? They're going to say yes.
And the common sense piece that I'm wondering about is how we would ever go about actually implementing this, how the counties would actually... So what to do this, then, the counties would have to have a list of every state and the amount of the benefits in every state, and then they have to match that up with the person and confirm that eligibility, and then they have to reprogram their computers for each state to send out a check. Do you have any idea, have you talked to the counties about how they would go about implementing? I mean, because that's really the common sense practical question from their
right.
perspective.
Mr. Chair, I have talked to some folks. They are concerned about the implementation of having people from multiple places. Now, California had passed this, not exactly a conservative bastion. That is the court case that went to the Supreme Court.
And
so
how did that case come up?
Well, that's what Representative Huntley alluded to.
Oh, that was so this specific thing was stuck. No, it's not this specific thing. Okay, that's what I
longer period of time.
Wanted to clarify that.
Thank you.
But I think the constitutional issue, though, is treating different people from different states differently. But
the constitutional issue, Mr. Chair, was a right to travel, a constitutional right to travel.
And you're discriminating by on the right
Mr.
to travel.
Chair,
but you don't have to resolve that question.
Travel, I'm just saying that we aren't going to.
My question, though, is so you have heard from the counties that they would have difficulty implementing something where you'd have to have 50 different states and sending out checks depending on where someone came from. And then having to switch that after a year to go up to the regular level,
Mr.
to the Minnesota
Chair,
level.
I have heard concerns from people on implementation.
Okay, and if the counties wanted to come down and testify about that, that would be okay. But Representative Gottwell. Oh, so Representative Liebman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up here. Representative Seifert, you've kind of changed the parameters of the data you were giving us, the 13,000, and I'd like to see that data, but the issue, though, here, your bill doesn't relate to all our programs. It relates to general assistance payments and MFIT payments. And so I think that's the relevant issue here, whether people are coming into our state for the purpose of getting those benefits, because that's what your bill addresses. And if you have data on that, I wish you would present it to us in a clear way. And you know, this is an important bill. This is an important issue. I think you should be giving us some real solid data here that we can consider. That's what we have these committees for. So, you know, I'd like to see that, and I hope you'll provide it to the committee.
Mr. Chair, my office is right over here. Maybe while these gentlemen are testifying, I can go get that, and I can get the map that accompanies it on first-time applicants by county as well, and that might help convince Representative Liebling to support the bill.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Eric Rathman, and I'm with MACSA. In talking to my members about this, their main concern is that the county would have to manually verify the benefits set, and for the reasons that Mr. Chair raised, that would be extremely difficult for the counties to implement.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Stan Groff. I represent the Minnesota Social Services Association. A lot of our members are financial workers who would deal with this proposed language, and I'm a recently retired county director. In polling counties, many of them, the kinds of questions that came up about that had to do with how this would get done. And so normally what a financial worker does is to contact the other state and either the state system or the county system that provides MFIT benefits in that state, and then get to the caseworker that had that case and find out what the benefit was with a release of information authorization form that they would have had to have gotten in advance. And then they would, once they've secured and verified that information from the other state, MACSIS, as you know, the state database system, has to be normally compute benefits, but in a situation like this where it would be computing a different benefit, they would have to do what's known as a FIAT. FIAT is the acronym, and it's a workaround within the system. So after the work had been done, then there's more work to do to actually get the master system to spit out the benefit that would be called for under this bill. They also raised a few questions about two-parent benefit households versus one-parent benefit households, Mr. Chairman. They also raised the issue about food support, and would it be different from the MFIP grant then? Would that be bifurcated or separated? One county wondered how many really new families this is. A lot of people who came back here to apply for benefits from another state are folks who are actually moving back here, who started out here, that are Minnesotans originally. And the last... and the last concern was increasing caseloads, Mr. Chairman, in a time of dwindling resources to process those cases. Thank you.
Well, we have some other questions.
That's fine. This is the committee. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, I just want to make a brief reminder. I made this speech on the House floor today, and I would remind people as well, when we have people before us presenting a bill, no matter what we think of the issue, they deserve respect for what they're bringing forward. And I respect Representative Liebling's request for specific information, but I've heard on at least the last two bills aspersions to the motivation of the person bringing the bill and why they're asking for these sorts of things. And questioning some of those things. And I think we deserve, when we bring a bill before a committee, to listen with open minds to what's being presented and not question those motivations. And specifically, I refer to some of the words that have been used in questioning. Let's just leave that as a reminder. Specifically with regard to welfare, I've been approached by people in my own county, who have unsolicited brought to me specific examples. These are county workers who deal with people on these programs, who speak volumes about the fraud and the misuse and the concern about people who don't get it, who don't receive the help that they should get because other people are using it inappropriately. So it's fair to say that this is an issue and to bring forward ideas like this. And we can talk about the fact that the bill may not work the way we want it to or create complications for counties, but let's not ask questions or make statements in a way that impugns the motives of the person bringing the bill forward.
Thank you, Representative Gottwald. I'm not, well, anyway. Can we, Mr. Rushi?
Mr. Chair, while he's coming forward, I did have the information handed out that we used that we requested from the DHS department. This is the map that was made at our request that reflects percentage-wise percentage-wise is different than raw numbers, obviously, because of the counties, but I think most people would say if you've got 49% coming from another state, if you don't want to do this bill, what is our answer for solving the issue? Because I think there is an issue here. And you have the expertise that I'm not on this committee, and if this isn't the right issue, the right bill to solve the problem, what do we do? And I think Minnesotans are deserving an answer if it's not this one.
Thank you. Mr. Rush.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Brian Rushi with the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition. Our coalition represents the Minnesota Council of Churches, the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the Jewish Community Relations Council, and the Islamic Center of Minnesota. We oppose House File 1036, which imposes a 12-month residency requirement and establishes a two-tiered safety net system, which is designed to offer less assistance to people who recently moved here if they had received public assistance from certain states. I know that this bill is here because it wants to address what is a perceived magnet problem, and I guess I'd like to underscore what Representative Liebling said is you know, do we have a definition of the problem that really works here? I think any serious study of this issue would have to include what number of people on public assistance in Minnesota move out of the state. What's the net effect? We're only looking at one side of the equation. We oppose this bill because it would certainly trigger a court case. Representative Huntley talked about that. We think in this time of economic crisis and budget deficits, it's just very worrisome to see us waste resources on a legal defense on a proposal that we believe is indefensible, not only on the federal constitutional level, the right to travel, but also Minnesota human rights law forbids discrimination on the basis of status of public assistance. And we would have differential treatment depending on the public assistance status of a person from another state. So for practical reasons, cost reasons, I don't think we've defined the problem well. And then finally, on moral reasons. Our religious communities minister on a daily basis to thousands of people, sheltering them overnight in our buildings and feeding them in our kitchens. And we're in direct contact and conversation with people. And we know the stories of people who have moved here because they're down on their luck, many of whom are fleeing for their well-being. This bill, I believe, and I know the author doesn't intend to, but I think it questions the motives of newcomers in an unfair way. And it would have the effect of further stigmatizing people in poverty. And it would make poverty all the more difficult to overcome because of the lesser benefits. Our community, I believe, is called to end poverty, not to make it worse. And this bill, along with the EBT restrictions bill, I think pours salt in the wounds of people who are already struggling. Now, it may be true in isolated cases that someone moves here to trade up welfare benefits, but I think that that is very isolated, and it's an anecdote that makes poor law. We believe that people move here because they perceive better opportunities, safer streets, and to be closer to relatives and friends, a story that should sound familiar to almost all of us. At the base of their decision is this, the freedom to declare a new domicile. And incidentally, Minnesota tax law says you're a Minnesota resident when you declare a new domicile. And for people that arrive here from other states, they pay sales tax and property tax to the former rent on day one. They're under Minnesota law. This freedom to move about and to start over has an ancient meaning. Freedom is connected to home and to homecoming. And in the case of indigent people who are making a new home, we should at least offer equality under the law. And the clear standard in our traditions for whether we are a good and decent people is whether we're actually welcoming of the newcomer. We would prefer that the energy behind this bill go into efforts to streamline and make more effective our public benefit system. I have a copy of my testimony I'd like to distribute to the committee, and thank you very much for the opportunity.
Ms. Mason, and we have about 2 minutes, if you could. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rolanda Mason. I'm an attorney. I work for St. Cloud Area Legal Services, where I represent low-income people in central Minnesota. I'm here to speak against this provision. Racial residency requirements, which is what this is, are not new. States have tried this numerous times over the last several decades, and in fact, in Minnesota, it has been tried twice before. These efforts have consistently been found to be unconstitutional. Most of the residency requirements are similar to the one that's proposed here today, in that they offer a lesser benefit level to newer residents. And that certainly is not a distinction that has saved them. The courts have, as I said, consistently found them to be unconstitutional. Minnesota first tried to impose the racial residency requirement in 1991. At that time, we were facing a budget problem, and the state imposed a 6-month residency requirement for people who were receiving general assistance benefits. And this was seen as a way to reduce costs and to direct limited resources to longer-term Minnesota residents. The court rejected this this residence requirement, finding it to be a violation of both the federal constitution and the state constitution. In that, the court held that conservation of limited funds was not a valid state interest that recognized the right to restrict travel as protected by the U.S. Constitution. Despite having had a six-month residency requirement rejected in 1993, we tried again in 1996. This time we instituted a statute that imposed a 12-month durational residency requirement on recipients of the MFIP program and on recipients of general assistance. That residency requirement looked very, very much like the one that's before you today. That case was litigated as well, and the court found that, again, the residency requirement was unconstitutional. While that case was pending in front of the Minnesota Supreme Court on appeal, the state appealed that to the Minnesota Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court issued its decision in Anderson v. Roe. That's the California case that also imposed a nearly identical one-year residency requirement. In that case, the United States Supreme Court found that the residency requirement was unconstitutional, violating the federal constitution's right to travel. The court rejected the argument that the impact on travel was only incidental and said that it didn't matter, that it was the discriminatory classification of a new resident was what caused the statute to be unconstitutional. That was consistent with all the prior rulings of the United States Supreme Court. Since 1969, the United States Supreme Court has had several opportunities to review durational residency requirements. And in every single situation, the U.S. Supreme Court has held that durational residency requirements are, in fact, unconstitutional. There have been no exceptions before the U.S. Supreme Court. I think that it's interesting to note and important to note that when the court made its decision in 1999 in the California case, that was a 7-2 decision, and that Justices Kennedy and Scalia, current justices on the court, voted with the majority in that case. There's only one current sitting justice that voted in opposition, and that was Justice Thomas. So there certainly is, the composition of the court has not changed sufficiently for anyone to have a basis for believing that a different decision would happen at this point in time. Other courts around the country, state courts, have also had a case, and like Minnesota has, to evaluate durational residency requirements. And overwhelmingly, those courts, both federal and state courts, have rejected these provisions as unconstitutional. I think it's very clear that this bill, as it's drafted, would not pass constitutional muster, and it has been stated by Representative Huntley and others in the room today, it would simply be a waste of what is already limited resources on something that is destined to fail.
President Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the point of the testifier on the left up there, sir, and Representative Seifert's information, I was going to make that same point, that this is only one half of the equation. I would like to request that the department present to the committee as soon as they're able to the other side of this in terms of what the outflow is from each of these counties to other states or other parts of the world. There's net inflows and net outflows all the time. And it's just, I have no idea what those results would be, but I'd like to see them. Secondly, I'd like to see this, ask if there's someone from the department here to comment on. The state demographer did a study of this, I believe, in 2003 or 2004. That was mentioned in briefings we received earlier this session when Evie Card and other discussions occurred about this, and I believe maybe someone present in the room from the department recalls the specifics of those results. Generally, I believe they found no significant net difference, that there's inflow and outflow, and there wasn't any statistically significant huge net difference on the inflow. So that's what would be relevant to whether or not we're solving a problem.
Mr. Johnson, I don't know if you have information on that.
Mr. Chair, I asked the question Representative Bunn did to the department, and essentially what they said is when someone ends public assistance, no matter what the program is, generally they don't track that data of where they go. Are you heading out of state? Are you going somewhere else? Generally, people will leave. And if Mr. Johnson has any new information, but generally the information I got when I asked the same question was they don't know the net effect because when people end the end. They don't say where they're heading to or if they're staying in Minnesota.
And I was asking Mr. Johnson about the other report where they did an analysis of whether was it the legislative auditor or
the
state demographer analyzed this issue. And he's, I don't know if he knows, but he can tell us.
Mr. Chair, Chuck Thompson, Department of Human Services. I believe that the demographer did do a study of inflows and outflows. I don't recall the results of it. I believe it was, as Representative Bunn suggested, pretty much a net. But they were looking, I believe, at low-income families who may have used public assistance sometime in one year or another. They can only do that study, as I understand it, with the decennial census. So it would have been based on 2000. There'd be no way to update it until we're sometime past the next census, probably a couple of years in order to get that level of data. Okay. The auditor also did look at this question in, I think it was a 2002 study that they did on welfare reform, and concluded that most of the studies identify that there is some degree to which migration is probably attributable to the difference in benefits among states, as basic economic theory suggests that at some level you're going to get at the margin. That's going to be some of what's going on. Most of the studies that ask people why they're moving, the people will say that they're moving come back to where they used to live because family is here, for better schools, for a better neighborhood, those kinds of reasons. At the margin, there probably is some related to benefits, but the main reasons people give are not necessarily related to benefits, but to other reasons why people would be moving.
Just a quick follow-up to the department. In briefings we had early in the session when the issue of EBT cards being used out of state was raised, I believe we were told that they're legally required to report within 10 days of leaving the state for any reason. Those who are in the EBT cards are cash assistance and food stamps. So this result, this answer Representative Seifert got that we don't have the information to track that is a little odd to me given that comment we heard earlier that they are required to report when they leave the state. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative, they are required to report if they move the state. They don't always do that. Sometimes people just don't report, and then we close their case. And whether they moved or decided they didn't need assistance anymore because they got a job or something else happened with them, we usually just don't get good information back from the people as to why they no longer are reporting as they're supposed to on a monthly basis, and so we close the cases. And we often don't know why, which is why the demographer study is the only way to really look at the inflow-outflow question.
Thank you. And just so members know, we're obviously not going to finish all these bills today. My sense is we're going to come back tomorrow at 10 a.m. to finish up the bills. We have other people on the line. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to just think about this in another context. Well, first of all, I wanted to be sure that we were clear when we talked about this. Representative Seifert, you had said that that one of the possible reasons that people could be coming back is to extend their benefit months, that maybe they're coming from a state and they've used up all their benefits and they want to start here. In talking about it anecdotally of researching in the room, I don't think that's the case. I think that those months are tracked across the state if they're on a TANF program. So I just want to be sure as we put the context in the frame motivation that that's something that people can't do, so that wouldn't be a reason for them to move to our state. The other question that I have, or the other thought that I have is, and it was what I was trying to get at with Representative Avery's bill, is that we make these kind of broad policy changes and then we sweep up folks. Like, I'm thinking about the mom in my district who came back from Iowa to take care of her mother, and she had children. And that not only is the right and the moral thing to do, but that's helping the state save money because that mom doesn't have to go to a nursing home. That the daughter can actually help the mother. And in doing that, she brought her children, and she, I don't know if she was working or not, but she needed some assistance. So she's receiving input as she is helping her mother, and now all of that income is being reported in the house. So that's something that is helping, our state. That's helping our seniors and the elderly, and it's something that we are, asking and expecting people to do. So I just want to be sure that as we kind of walk around anecdotally, and you said that a lot, and this time you brought some data, but I've heard you say a lot that in talking to people in your district, this is what they say. Well, when I talk to people in my district, they say things that are different. So I think that we need to make this relative, and I would hope that the folks in your district are similar to mine, and you've been to my district a couple of months ago, but I just want to be sure that when we talk about this, we don't talk about this as though if this is common sense, because the folks in my district feel much differently about a lot of these issues than I think that it sounds like folks in your district do. Thank you.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just quickly, I see Ms. Mason left. Ms. Mason, the California case that you referred to, I don't believe, and maybe you didn't say this, but I don't believe that case held that any durational residency requirement was unconstitutional. It just said, as I recall, the decision you referred to said the durational residency requirement in the California law was unconstitutional. And in fact, I believe that in certain benefit situations, there is a Wisconsin durational residency requirement that has been upheld. Are you aware of that one?
As to your first point, the decision in California, the court, as in all court challenges, the court looks at the statute that's before it. In that case, the statute was a California residency statute that imposed a 12-month durational residency requirement. The court held that that was unconstitutional. The court's ruling, what the court said about that in rejecting an argument that was brought forth by the state of California, was that it was the discriminatory classification of deciding that somebody was a new resident, which is what made that unconstitutional. I think that's an important holding because it relates directly to your second part of your question, which is the case out of Wisconsin called James versus Milwaukee. It's a 1992 case. It was decided before the Supreme Court case out of California we were just discussing.
Still good law.
That is the only case, the only reported case out of dozens of residency cases that where any court has ever found that a durational residency requirement or statute be upheld. In that case, it was a 60-day residency requirement. That case was not brought to the U.S. Supreme Court, but I think we have to look at that case in light of the holding of the California case, which said that it was the discriminatory classification that made the statute invalid. And that, I think, in the minds of most lawyers who look at this, raises in serious doubt whether the Wisconsin statute or case would be upheld in light of the subsequent U.S. Supreme Court decision.
That's the second time today, Mr. Chair.
Fair enough.
Ms. Mason, well, that's a little bit different from your testimony earlier because apparently I may not fall in with most lawyers then, but that's a little different than saying that it absolutely is unconstitutional, that people would say arguably the California case controls. In fact, the Wisconsin case is still good law, and I believe, and I'll go back and look, because if I'm wrong, so be it. But I believe that the California case was specific to the right to travel in that case, and it left open the question of whether a durational residency requirement of less than 12 months might be constitutional under certain circumstances. And that's all I wanted to be clear, because your testimony earlier made it sound like this is a closed-door issue, it should never be raised, and I tend to disagree with that. And I would ask you this. I want to know, do you care about the integrity, maintaining the integrity of our existing public programs, making sure that they exist for those people that are most in need? Is that something you care about?
Representative Emmer, Mr. Chair, yes, of course I care about that program. These programs are important and they benefit a lot of people, but we must administer these programs consistent with the law.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Mason, then if you care about the integrity of these programs, making sure that they remain in existence for those that are most in need, that are having extremely difficult times, our Minnesota citizens, then can you tell me why, what reforms should we be doing in order to make sure that we still have any program within the next decade the way we're headed? Or do we just keep trying to find ways to throw money at it? Is that the answer?
Hi, Representative Emmer, Mr. Chair. I believe there are a lot of things that we could do to improve the program. However, one thing that we cannot do is impose unconstitutional limitations in the program. And that's what I believe this bill does.
Mr. Chair, and I'll be done. Ms. Mason, I can't tell you how much I appreciate the dialogue, regardless of how it might be perceived by some. I think it's a discussion that we have to have, because I see a day coming when we may not be able to provide such assistance. I mean, at the rate we're going, you got to be able to pay for the stuff, and we need to make sure that people in need have a place to turn. And in order to do that, we've got to be, as decision makers, policy makers, we've got to be conscious of the fact that we've got limited resources. And if the only answer is eliminating programs completely because you can't afford to fund them, that's the wrong answer. So at some point, we've all got to figure out whether the constitutional issue is in play or not. We've got to figure out how to make sure that these programs are in existence for those people who absolutely have to have them.
I totally agree that we have to preserve the program. I would say, though, that making decisions that are going to cost the state a lot of money in litigation costs and not to further the objectives that you've identified in a tight budget cycle actually jeopardizes the program rather than protecting it.
Representative Huntley. And we have three people that still want to say something, so we go.
Maybe to get it back on track again, to show what a moderate and good worker I am with working with everyone, why don't we on 1.9 and 1.17 change the 12 months to 3 months to go to the Wisconsin standard, so maybe we could at least get a nugget or a crumb of reform, and it would be constitutional. We'd have it in the neighboring states. Listen to everybody who came forward who had the concerns about wasting money with the Attorney General. Representative Huntley can zap it into his omnibus bill and everybody will be happy. So if Representative Emmer maybe would move, I see Representative Abler left the room. So
I think it was 60 days, though, wasn't it, in Wisconsin?
I like the 90. I'll move that.
Okay. 90 days.
We'll try 90.
So the motion is on 1.9 and 1...
3 months, I'm sorry. Strike 12 and insert 3.
1.9 and 1.7, it's 3 months. Instead of 12. Any discussion? All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail. Okay. Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I'm kind of torn here because I wish it would come to my committee because I'd like to ask George Hoffman to do the fiscal notes on this. Because I'm quite sure that he would find there was no savings and, in fact, a rather large legal fee involved with this bill. So if it does pass, I will certainly ask for a fiscal vote on it, which I will then send to Representative Seifert and ask him how we're going to pay for it.
Mr. Chair, if I could ask Representative Emmer to try 2 months, which is apparently the... gentlelady next to me said that's what the Wisconsin standard was, so I misspoke. If I could have someone move 2 months, then we shouldn't have any problem with legal fees, and we'll be able to go to the next committee.
2 months.
Representative Emmer moves 2 months on 1.9 and 1.17. To the discussion of the amendment, Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair, my understanding of the Wisconsin amendment is that it is not that it has met constitutional muster, it just has not been challenged to the level of the Supreme Court. And I think Ms. Lemire has reviewed the legal history, might be able to confirm that.
Ms. Lemire.
Mr. Chair and members, I think that Representative Loeffler is right that the Wisconsin case went to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, but not the U.S. Supreme Court.
Okay. No further discussion. All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The motion doesn't prevail. Representative Gottwald. Representative Rood.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make a quick comment if I can. I just first want to say that I'm so grateful that I had the foresight to be born on the right side of the ocean and into a stable and loving family. Some of the bills we've heard today, I think, elicit a real visceral response. You can feel that, I think, in the room. And unfortunately, I think that they appeal to our darker side. And that there is a budget deficit is true. And that there will be more poor people, I think, unfortunately, is true. And that we have limited resources is true. And we do need to make sure that we can eliminate the fraud, because we do want those who are needy to get the resources that they need. And Mr. Chair, when these bills were on the agenda today, at first I was puzzled. But I have to tell you that as a member of the Health Policy Committee, I'm glad we had this public debate. And I hope, I'm disappointed, quite frankly, that we didn't take the vote on the fingerprinting and defeat it. Because these will come up as floor amendments. And I think it's important that the public know that we did have a full public debate on these policies, and I hope that we, no offense, Representative Cypher, go on to defeat this one as well.
Okay. The roll has been called on the bill. Representative Cypher, closing comments?
Well, Mr. Chair, I am disappointed that Representative Emmer's, the two-month one shows to me that people aren't even interested in a reasonable standard. I don't think a 60-day standard is unreasonable, and I think that in Minnesota Supreme Court, I think would hold up. I don't think that's an unreasonable standard. I'm not a lawyer, but I play one on TV, and I think 12 months you can make a good faith argument, but I think at this point it looks like folks just aren't interested in reform at all. Not even if I asked for 31 days, I don't think people would pass it. You just simply have your mind made up that you don't see that this map is an issue where almost one half of a county's first-time recipients applying for public assistance are from another state. You maybe not think that's a problem, but my constituents and I do believe that's a problem. Probably not going to win the vote today, but we'll bring it out to the Court of Public Opinion and see what they think later. So I appreciate your time, and I appreciate the hearing, Mr. Chair. You didn't have to give me one, and I want to thank you for that.
You're welcome. We're going to go to the vote. Representative Norton had something to say. I apologize, Representative Seifert.
I'm sorry. I was out of the room for a few moments, and I think my name was taken off the list, and I apologize for that. I do want to say this was an important discussion today, and I won't be able to vote for the bill with 12 months in it. I did support the amendment for two, and because I have many constituents who have that concern, and I thought two would have been a reasonable option, but it's not the will of this committee, so I will be voting against the 12 months. But the point I wanted to make earlier is it looks like we would be implementing a standard if we had approved this for another state. We would have said, if you come from Mississippi, whatever you got in Mississippi would be good here. And I have serious concerns about how will we get people to come to the state to fill the jobs in the future that we're going to need to fill if the cost of living that they're going to be coming to will be held to a Mississippi standard. This isn't Mississippi. This is Minnesota. And folks will need it to come here and to be able to live in the standard that Minnesota has. And I'm afraid other states just would not provide that level of funding. And I think there's cost of living differences between states, and this bill didn't address that. And so I did have concerns. I just wanted that on the record, and I thank you for tolerating that comment.
All right. We're going to go to the town quickly.
Well, Mr. Chair, I've been lectured twice today by Representative Gottwald about not referring to the motives of another member, and maybe Representative Gottwald will give that same lecture to Representative Seifert.
Okay. The clerk will take the roll. I'll renew the motion that House File 1036 be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
Thiessen.
No.
Abler. Broad.
Yes.
Bunn.
Yes.
Emmer.
Yes.
Fritz.
No.
Gardner.
No.
Gottwald.
Yes.
Hayden.
No.
Huntley.
No.
Kelly.
Yes.
Lane.
No.
Liebling.
No.
Loeffler.
No.
Mack.
Yes.
Murphy.
No.
Norton.
No.
Wood.
No.
Tao.
No.
Torkelson.
Yes.
Abler.
There's 7 ayes, 12 nays. The motion does not prevail. And we're not going to meet tomorrow. So We'll bring this bill back up next Thursday, your next bill back up next okay. Thursday, probably in the evening. That's the likelihood.
Whatever.
Okay.
Sure.
And also Representative Fritz. Okay. Thank you. We're adjourned.
Thank you.